Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here today. Today, we are going to be talking about an interesting topic, magic. What is magic? What is a love potion? Omens, supernatural, immortality, healing? A lot of people have been talking about all of these words these days. We see all of the chemtrails up in the sky, and we say, what's coming down from the sky? We say, there's a lot of other things going on. Where are all these earthquakes coming from? Is the earth starting to shift, or is it changing? And we say, what is really healing? A placebo? Boy, that topic's been thrown around on this show quite a bit. And when we say these words, we say, where did these concepts even come from? Well, today I have a great guest who will be able to tell us all of the stories about the magical and the science. The book is Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers. The author is Matt Kaplan. Thank you so much for joining us today, Matt. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Matt, don't you think the world is changing like crazy these days? You know, we're seeing all of these different concepts, and we're saying, oh, that's just an old folks' tale, or, you know, and then we see these shows that have a lot of supernatural stuff and just talking about the future, and in the middle is where we are in reality. Things are changing.
Well, I don't think the world from the perspective of, So, yes, the world is changing. There's no question that our world is changing, and it's changing fast. But I don't hold that up to anything supernatural whatsoever. We, as a species, have populated this planet at an astronomical rate. There are so many people here, and we are living out our lives, using resources, and interacting with the planet in such dynamic ways that the planet's never been exposed to before. So you've got, I mean, we're talking about pollution here, really. The planet is being exposed to an enormous amount of pressures that it never was exposed to before. And as a result, we're seeing changes happen on a scale that they never occurred before. So, for example, I mean, in the book we talk about mechanisms by which our ancient ancestors tried to control the weather. The Native Americans engaged in rain dances. And, you know, you look at what was being done. They would drape themselves with blue stones. I'm blanking on the name of it. They would blanket themselves with blue stones. They would cover themselves in feathers to represent the wind. And they would hope that their dance would bring rain to give their crops water. But, you know, there's nothing to that other than, hey, let's hope that it's going to rain. And I think the dance probably made everyone feel a lot better, but I don't think it actually summoned any storms. Today, we have the ability, and there is the technology to do it, to control the weather. Certainly before the Beijing Olympics in 2008, the government threw up pellets into the air with that were frozen carbon dioxide, and it caused the clouds to congeal around the pellets, and this created rain in certain areas such that rain clouds would rain out before reaching the Beijing Olympics area. So they were effectively controlling weather in a really big way. It's expensive, but when you got an event like the Olympics, it was deemed by the Chinese government to be worthwhile. And that's the kind of thing that our ancestors would have just gasped at. And to a certain extent, if we could demonstrate it, they would have said, wow, that's magic. So we are seeing big changes. Most of them are caused by us, but in a lot of ways, technology and science are giving us the opportunity to take action.
Do you think, in a way, these stories and these concepts that are coming into our minds and our thoughts is what we're then able to, now that science has expanded so much, we're able to start acting on? In other words, the rain dance, you know, we would have never thought that you could actually affect change in the skies, you know, all of those decades and centuries ago, but here now we see it. So maybe that concept somewhere in our minds started to manifest forward. So when eventually, like, the ideas and the concepts and science collide, that's when you start having more answers and more able to influence it going forward.
I think that there's a fair amount of reticulation, sort of a back and forth, between mythology, ritual, belief, and science. You've got, in some circumstances, areas where science does a wonderful job of priming our fictions. So, you know, a really good example of that would be Avatar. We know that Jim Cameron was working with botanists to become inspired by a lot of the content that actually finds its way into Avatar. To explain very briefly, we know that when you infest a plant with aphids, which are insects that eat tomato plants, the other plants in the surrounding area begin releasing chemicals that summon wasps to the area to go and attack the aphids. So it's a defense mechanism used by the plants, and they send a signal through their roots to fungi, which then connect to other plants. And therefore, there's this alarm system saying, hey, we're being attacked. Predators of the natural world come and attack these aphids. And so you look at the credits of Avatar, and we know that Jim Cameron was influenced by this research because he has the researchers in the credits of the film. So that's a great example of modern fiction being driven, in many cases, by modern science and what we see in the natural world. But it can also go the other way. You can have ideas that are inspirational to us, and then because the dream is there, we pursue it with, you know, doggedly pursue it in some cases and really try to make it real. So a good example of that would be like calling lightning bolts down from the sky. That's the stuff of mythology. People in ancient times looked at lightning and said, wow, wouldn't it be incredible if we could do that? And we're very much on the verge of being able to do that. Currently, the main way to do it is you shoot rockets up into thunderstorms, and the rockets are connected to tiny cables, and when the rocket is hit by a lightning bolt in the midst of the thunderstorm, lightning travels down the cable and hits whatever the cable is connected to. This isn't used for warfare. It's used for testing electrical shielding on airplanes. But the concept is there, and now researchers are trying to do it with lasers. They use lasers. They shoot them into thunderstorms. The laser rips apart electrons in the clouds, and the lightning bolt can begin to climb down the laser, which means you can, in many cases, direct lightning bolts, which is like the stuff of our wildest dreams. But because people have been dreaming about it, they've started exploring, well, could we actually do it? And that, that's what we see quite a lot.
Yeah, it's like the concept actually starts forming when you start, you know, when there's so many things start to collide in our experience. You know, you also talked about the moons and the earth and the sun, and, you know, I've been in healthcare for 45 years, and I can tell you it has been a concept people would always say, you know, well, is it a full moon, you know, and they talk about mental health in the ERs. But really what we're seeing more about what's coming into ERs these days is more lung conditions and fluid retention in people and people not being able to breathe, which is being just before the full moon. We know that the tides, you know, come in. What's happening in the human beings is that they're just filling up with water and they're not able to release it. Then if you keep them in the hospital for a period of time, 3 to 4 days later, all of a sudden they have this huge release of water. It is the most incredible thing to watch.
Well,
and actually
the academic literature on that front is pretty sketchy. So the pools, we definitely see that the tides are affected by the moon. No question at all. When you have huge, huge bodies of water, the moon does have an effect, and you do have high and low tide. Mm-hmm. Even in the Great Lakes, we do see a response to the lakes when you've got full moon versus a quarter or no moon. So we know that the moon can have an effect on huge bodies of water, but when you go to smaller lakes or ponds, we see zero effect. When you look at the amount of water in the human body, there is absolutely no way that the moon can have an effect on the body of water in the human body. But that doesn't mean that the moon is not having an effect. And there is some research which is looking at the ways in which the moon has an effect on the way in which we sleep, which you probably noticed in the book. There was a team in Switzerland who were looking they were not looking at the moon effect. That was not their original intent. They were conducting a large-scale sleep study and looking at how people at different ages and different stages of their lives slept, how many hours, what stages of sleep were they in, at what time, and to make sure that the people were not being influenced by outside conditions, they had all of the sleep study conducted inside a bunker inside a mountain in Switzerland. So there was no light, there was no moon, you couldn't see anything, it was just all deep indoors. And what they found in their study was that at the times of the full moon, people slept less. That there was no question at all that that was what they were seeing. It was in general, are you familiar with non-REM sleep?
Right, right.
So non-REM sleep is the very deep kind in which we tend to dream. That form of sleep decreased by 30% on average. The overall sleep dropped by, it took 5 minutes longer for people to fall asleep during the full moon, and they lost 20 minutes of sleep overall during their night. And so that study was published in the journal Current Biology. It's a peer-reviewed journal, so scientists have to approve the publication and say, yep, this study was conducted in a reasonable manner. And since the time of that study being published, which was, I want to say 2011, but I could be wrong. It might have been more recent than that. Yeah, I'm wrong, 2013. Since 2013, there have been three other studies that have been conducted to see if they could replicate the findings of this Swiss team's work. Two of them found that they could. The results were identical. One of them found that they could not. Replication is the gold standard of good science. If you can replicate a study, then you know, then your results are likely real. So the fact that two teams have replicated and one team has not means they just got to keep fishing and see what they find. But the bigger question that you got to ask yourself is, why on earth would the full moon have an effect on our sleep? One argument that people make is, well, when the full moon is out, there's more light out, and that disrupts our sleep. But this study was conducted in a bunker, so the people were not exposed to moonlight. So what's going on? One of the hypotheses is that it's related to a lunar sense. Just as we are in tune to the rising and falling of the sun, we certainly have some seasonal effects as well. When we are in wintertime, our bodies respond differently to stimuli than they do during the summertime. One of the hypotheses is that we have a lunar sense as well. And that's not crazy, because there are other species that have a lunar sense. There are iguanas on the Galapagos Islands that respond very strongly to the moon when they're, and they have a tidal sense as well. They can detect when there's high and when there's low tide, and when the tide is going to be an extreme low tide, which happens at the time of the full moon. So why would that matter to iguanas? Well, when there's an extreme low tide, it means they can get more food because they eat algae off the bottom of the coast. And so if there's an extreme low tide, they're going to get a better meal than if it's a kind of a skimpy low tide at a crescent moon. So that raises all kinds of questions as to why would humans have a tide sense or an ability to detect the time of the moon? Why would we have a full moon ability? Why would our bodies sleep less well at that time? And no one's really sure. My hypothesis, which I present in the book, is that 15,000 years ago, we spent a lot of time along the coasts of Africa, and actually long before that as well, and we were very dependent upon shellfish. So if you depended upon shellfish, then your diet is dependent upon the tides, because you can only get as much shellfish as the water goes out. The deeper the water, the harder it is to get food. There may have been something to the fact that humans were having to depend upon this food source and depend upon tides being relatively shallow. But again, that's just total speculation. We really don't know. But what we do know is that this Swiss study has been replicated twice, and that's worth something, and we got to keep looking at it and see what they find in the future.
And what you've really done in your book is you've taken a lot of the concepts and ideas about magic, and you've actually put the science to them. And you list on the bottom of the page everything. There's a lot of references to a lot of studies and a lot of answers and a lot of documentation. This is why it is. So I think that's really important for a lot of people to understand. This is not just telling stories. This is showing the science behind the magical, as the name of the book, which is really important. Now, I think this one is really interesting, where you talk about the lead in the eye products. You know, it's so interesting because now we have so many people saying they're on the bandwagon of taking nitric oxide to be able to, you know, for anti-aging. And you talk about, you know, that in your book, you know, with the increase in the nitric oxide, you know.
You're talking about the Egyptians, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in 1902, Georges Bénédict from the Louvre Museum in Paris went out to the Saqqara Pyramid in Egypt. And during his expedition, they found a tomb, and in the tomb they found jars of makeup. And on the walls in the tomb they found hieroglyphics, which revealed that if you wore this makeup around your eyes in the manner of the god Horus, you would be protected by a blessing from that god. Then your eye would be protected as Horus's eyes were protected. Now that may sound a little bit crazy, but the mythology surrounding Horus, Horus is the falcon-headed god of Egyptian mythology, and falcons have these black lines over their eyes. They're called malar stripes. And in all of the mythology, there's these tales of the evil god of war and storms known as Set attacking Horus and stabbing him in the eye. And every time Horus's eye is injured in some manner, it regenerates. His eye heals back. And so you've got these hieroglyphics that were found in 1902 saying, hey, you wear this makeup and your eye will be protected as Horus's eye was. So the team thought, wow, maybe this makeup had medicinal properties. So they started analyzing it, and they discovered that it was really rich in lead products, lead compounds known as laurionite and phocianite. And back in the day, when they realized that, this stuff is crazy rich in lead. Lead was considered and still is considered a poison. And so all of the Egyptian activity was considered crazy. The Egyptians weren't healing their eyes. They were poisoning themselves. But then in 2010, I'm a science correspondent at The Economist, I was covering a paper from the journal Analytical Chemistry where a researcher named Christian Amateur from the National Center for Scientific Research in Paris and Philippe Walter at the Louvre Museum, they pointed out that there might actually be something to the makeup after all. They pointed out that your immune system uses calcium ions, more specifically Ca2+, calcium ions to draw the attention of immune cells to certain areas. They can cause reactions whereby effectively the cavalry of your body comes to attack stuff that shouldn't be there. And calcium ions are used to set this off. They noticed that the calcium ions that are used by the body were almost identical to the lead ions that are found in these types of makeup. They had identical charges, identical coordination with water molecules, and they had nearly identical atomic radii. So they speculated that the makeup might actually have had triggered an immune response by the body that would have been beneficial. So they tested this out, and they found that calcium ions release nitric oxide in the body, which summons all of these immune cells to the area to come and attack anything present. And when they tested the same thing with the lead ions, they got an identical result. The nitric oxide increase in the area around where the lead oxide, where the lead ion makeup was applied, increased by 240%. Moreover, they found that this particular makeup that was used by the Egyptians had no toxic effect around the tissues of the eye. So that's pretty crazy, but it raises the question of why would the Egyptians care? Why would it matter to them that they could use makeup and look like their god and be protected? How did they put this together and why would it have mattered? And the answer, I think, comes from the Nile. When they were living in ancient Egypt, the only source of water that you had was the Nile River itself. And the Nile is loaded with bacteria. You take untreated water from the Nile and flush your eyes with it or wash your face with it, and the chances of getting an eye infection are pretty high. And eye infections today, no big deal. Go get some antibiotics from your doctor and treat the eye infection. But when you were living in a world where such treatment was unavailable, conjunctivitis could blind you. It could make you terribly sick and potentially prove lethal. So it makes sense to me that the Egyptians were looking to makeup and using the makeup and coming to the conclusion that this type of makeup prevented harm to their eye, because they would have had a standing army of immune cells sitting there right around their eyes ready to attack anything that came in from the Nile River water. So that's speculation. We can't know that for sure, but it gives us some insight into why our ancestors came up with this idea that the makeup of Horus might have been magical in some way. And incidentally, by the way, antibiotics are used today to kill bacteria straight out. And because they kill directly, any bacteria that are not vulnerable to the antibiotic are able to multiply and you get resistance. So antibiotics in this way are proving problematic because the bugs keep evolving and changing, and it's like trying to hit a moving target, and we're running out of antibiotics to use. The tactics that were used by the Egyptians, this mechanism of simply drawing immune cells to the area so they can better do their job, are very hard for bacteria to evolve against. It's almost impossible because your immune system adapts, the bacteria adapt, but the bacteria aren't being selectively killed off by the lead. They're just being attacked by your own immune system, which is being drawn to the area. So in many ways, the Egyptians were really onto something, and it's something that needs to be explored more thoroughly, and in fact is, by researchers around the world.
Today we discuss many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.
And which is the principle, myself as a naturopathic physician, is what we always ride upon. Because being able to know that, when you're giving antibiotics, you're doing the end cause. Where they're doing it is preventing it from entering, and right at the same time, your body taking care of it. Whereas antibiotics, you're just saying, oh, I see the end results, and let me just clean up the mess. You know, there's not really any other factor there. And, you know, it's interesting that we even say, too, about the lead and about the nitric oxide, because now it has been a huge push to get lead and other toxins out of any type of makeups or any type of things that you put on your body or into your body. And there's been a huge increase in using L-arginine and L-citrulline to increase nitric oxide in your body for anti-aging and also to activate that immune system. So we've kind of come full circle of looking at these things. While that may have taken place in Egypt so long ago, we still are looking at it and paying attention.
Yeah, the human body hasn't changed much over its existence. I mean, over the past 150,000 years, we're very much the same people that we were then, biologically. So our bodies function in the same way, and people have been tinkering with things that they found in the natural world for a very, very long time. Antibiotics are a new development. They are unquestionably essential to saving lives under certain circumstances. Are they being overused? Yes. But there are, a lot of teams that are working on new mechanisms that can better fight infections. And certainly the tactics used by the Egyptians are an area that are well worth exploring. I mean, there are a lot of teams that are not looking at mythology to develop alternatives to antibiotics. But certainly we can learn something from looking at this stuff.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about springs and water and healing waters. You know,
Sure.
Go to California, they've got sulfur springs. They swear it's the anti-aging thing when our body needs sulfur. But then you look at Our Lady of Lourdes, or also you look at Medjugorje with blessing water there. All of these waters, they say, have such healing powers. And you wonder, is it the power of prayer? Is it the power of the place that you're in? I mean, I lived in Sedona for over 10 years. Everybody spoke of the vortex, the healing power of this big energy vortex. So is it the energy of it, or is it the story of it, or is it the God?
So it's complicated. It's complicated. If you go back to one of the earliest sites of natural healing, you go to Bath in the UK, which was a Roman site in the late stages, but early on it was visited by people who were unwell, and it was both a place of rest and relaxation as well as a place that was viewed as religiously important. You would go and pray there to a god known as Aquasulis. And the concept of the site itself having any sort of magic, I think, largely stems from the fact that the springs were warm. Today, if you and I are cold, we turn on the heat. But this would not have been available to humans long ago. I mean, even 500 years ago, if it was really cold out, you'd have to light a fire, and you'd have to hope that that you had enough fuel to keep that fire going. And this was both expensive, time-consuming, and difficult. It was hard to stay warm long ago. And so if you were ill and it was cold, your chances of survival would go way, way, way down. We know from work done by Elizabeth Rapaski at the Roswell Institute for Cancer Research in New York that, in fact, animals that are, particularly mice, that are under cold conditions do much worse when fighting off diseases, particularly cancer, but others too, than if they are kept warm. In fact, being cold predisposes you to suffering from disease, and a lot of that stems from the fact that you only have so much energy in your body. So if you're spending a lot of energy staying warm, you're not allocating that energy to your immune system. As a result, you're much more likely to fall ill because your immune system is just not available to do its job. Way back when, if you were suffering from a disease and you went to warm pools that were geothermally warmed, because it's the power of the earth that's bringing the heat to these sites, and you go and you went to go and sit in them, then you would increase your chances of fighting off the disease. And it's not just that. I mean, we also know that there are all kinds of remedies associated with heat and cold to help relieve pain. If you have sinus congestion, hot, moist heat can help you to release that congestion. Similarly, if you've got arthritis, warm heat can be extraordinarily valuable. So it's easy to understand why our ancestors came to those sites and came to believe that they were both divine and associated with healing. There was nothing supernatural about it. It was simply a matter of the body responding to the warmth and the wet, which were useful.
And why you see a lot of people, you know, taking that concept forward. There was a huge migration to California, you know, and to Florida, where everybody said, I'm going to feel better if I go there. There's warmer weather there. There's more water, you know, and people did live longer. You know, was it their concept or their thoughts that they were going to live longer, or was it that they were out in the warm weather and, you know, being able to get around more times out of the year so they felt better? They weren't sedentary and they weren't, you know, as you said, just being in cold and just kind of locked up, they kind of really felt better. So that's really bringing that forward.
I'm not sure if I'm familiar with any significant literature on lifespan in Florida or Hawaii versus Massachusetts. I would love to look at that literature, but I really don't know if living in a seasonal environment grants you an average lifespan that is shorter than living in a tropical environment. I just don't have the data supporting that, and I would not be sure if that is actually so. But there is another side to this that's probably worth exploring, and that's the side associated with belief. Because in recent years, research being done in the realm of positivity has shown that if you are happy, and happy in the right way, your body experiences gene expression associated with the immune system. So, for example, and there are a couple of flavors of happiness. We'll get into two of them. One is known as eudaimonic happiness, which is best described as the happiness you might feel when helping an old lady cross the street. And then there's hedonic happiness, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's the happiness you feel when you win $1,000 in Vegas. And you and I would both describe those as, well, I feel happy right now. But practically, the team that was doing this work collected blood samples from people who were chronically eudaimonically happy or chronically hedonically happy. And they looked at how their genes were expressing themselves and what effect this had on the immune system. This got published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is really no slouch of a journal. The first paper was published in 2013, and then, as I was mentioning earlier, replication is the gold standard of science. The work was replicated again just this year. They found that if you are eudaimonically happy, so the happiness associated with helping an old lady cross the street, you express genes that help your immune system to much more effectively fight viruses and bacteria. Hedonic happiness? Nothing. You get more inflammation a bit, but there's no real immune benefit granted from hedonic happiness. So you can then take that and run with it and say, okay, so what causes eudaimonic happiness? Well, frankly, a lot of the activities encouraged by the Holy Scriptures support behaviors that would lead you to feel eudaimonically happy. Feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, helping the needy. These are not activities that are going to make you feel hedonically happy. They're activities that are going to make you feel good about engaging with your community in some significant way. And if that makes you happy, then it expresses eudaimonic happiness, which has this immune benefit. So you could also look at these holy sites where people were going, whether they had hot springs or not, and say the act of pinning your life up to this larger fabric of society, belonging to this larger religious group, knowing that you're going to visit the holy place of your God, that you and your family are going to sacrifice your most valuable goat, that all of this is going to bring you that happiness of community that does in fact generate an immune effect. And that's pretty awesome stuff. So you look at that, you look at the heat, you look at the social activities, and you realize that, you know, there is something to this. And because it's being replicated in the scientific field now, we can start to say, okay, right, so there is something here, and we should probably sit up and listen. It doesn't mean we should ignore traditional medicine entirely. In fact, I would argue that it means that traditional medicine needs to look at these activities and say, huh, okay, the issues of the mind should also be associated with the issues of immunology, because they do go hand in hand, and it's been largely ignored. So I think it's going to be a really interesting 10 years ahead as this area gets explored further.
Well, it absolutely will be. And also, you know what, let's talk a little bit about animals, plants, and guides and omens. You know, I live in New Orleans, and you can't go anywhere that, you know, downtown that you might not see something, and you'll say, it'll just ding in your head, and you'll notice it, and you'll just pass on because you don't think anything of it. And then you'll have tourists that will come into town. They'll go, what is this stuff? What is all this about? You know, we have a lot of voodoo. We have a lot of Cajun beliefs. There's a lot of different religions here. And really, it's all about all different, you know, guides. And you can go to all of the cemeteries that are above ground, and you'll see all kinds of artifacts everywhere. So really, you know, you can share a little bit about your stories, because I'll tell you, while it might not be in your area, it is in some areas, and it's just interesting to look at, I think.
So, right. Okay. I think the best place to start with talking about animals as omens and guides of the gods comes back to the Vikings. The Vikings had a god named Odin, who's pretty popular because of the Marvel superhero films, is played by Sir Anthony Hopkins. But way back when, Odin was a god who was associated with ravens. In fact, he was so commonly associated with ravens that he often was referred to as the Hrafnir god, which is a raven god. He also had two wolves who were his boon companions, and to see a wolf was viewed as a good omen. And that's right. Weird, because you've got all of this Viking literature which talks about if you lose sight of ravens, that's bad. If you see wolves, that's good. And it's so strange, because ravens and wolves are both scavengers, and they'll steal meat mm-hmm. whenever they can get it. So, you know, as I'm sure you have experience with, if you go hunting and go kill your elk and drag it home, but you realize the kids inside are, you know, really causing chaos, so you have to leave the elk outside for a couple minutes while you deal with the kids, ravens and wolves will come and steal your meat if you aren't on top of it, because we all have the experience of dragging elk back to the house. So it's weird to think that these animals would have been revered, and it raises questions as to why the Vikings thought they were so important. If you start looking at the larger picture, though, it starts to make some sense. Work being done in Yellowstone National Park, where wolves were recently introduced, revealed that the ravens living there, while they had followed bears and mountain lions and coyotes for decades, as soon as the wolves were reintroduced, the ravens started following the wolves to the exclusion of almost all else. They found that as soon as a wolf made a kill, ravens very quickly were on that kill. And similarly, the researchers found that while they were using radio telemetry to track the wolves, they really didn't need to, because the ravens created such a ruckus, they could spot the wolves from miles off just by looking at ravens. So that starts to raise all kinds of questions, because in Africa, we know that hunter-gatherer tribes follow vultures to lion kills, and then they use their spears to drive the lions off of their kill so they can steal a chunk of meat and go running back to their camp with it before the lions can get them. I asked a number of researchers, hey, is it possible that tribes in northern latitudes, which are all extinct now, once followed ravens to wolf kills and stole meat in the same way? And the hypothesis was largely, yes, my goodness, you probably could do that. So I ended up in Yellowstone in the middle of winter following ravens to see if there was any truth to this. The first raven led me to a dumpster, which was a little embarrassing. But as I followed other ravens, I came upon three wolves that were attacking an elk. And in fact, this attack was recorded on video by me, and we've got it on matteroffactandfiction.com, which is my website. And it was astonishing, because we continued to follow ravens throughout the rest of the week that I was there, and they were very consistently leading us to either active attacks by wolves or sites where wolves had made a kill. And after the wolves made their kill, you could see the kill from miles away, and it took the wolves about 3 days to strip the carcass of the meat. So you could easily get in there if that had been legal. The National Park didn't let us go and steal meat from wolves because there are all kinds of rules against that. But if you could steal meat from the wolves, you would have been able to do that. And so I think the reason the Vikings were worshipping ravens and wolves as, you know, the pets of their beloved Odin is largely down to the fact that they were probably following these animals, or at least their ancestors were, to food sites. Because you look at the literature and it says that Gyr and Frigg, which are the names of the wolves that belong to Odin, provided for the warfaring followers of their god. And to suggest that wolves would provide food seems so strange until you start to look at the larger ecology of it all. So I think that that's where that really comes from.
Well, I think that sometimes they're always also depend upon for sustenance. I mean, we're dependent upon something, and your god or your whatever you worship or hold forth is providing that, then that is what you will continue to hold up even higher in esteem in your life and your religion going forward, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that same concept. You know, we saw it here after Hurricane Katrina, you know, there was a certain great amount of the swamp area, and it was all washed out, and all of the cypress trees had died, and all of the moss had gone too. And it was interesting to look at when it was so desolate, there was only one thing that came back, and this huge eagle had put its nest right in the middle. And there's never been eagles there ever. And then as the swamp started to come back and everything, the eagle still is sitting there. And it's local people have all said that that's just that eagle has come in to be able to have protection, to take care, and to say that, you know, that nature would come back, and nature did come back. So, I mean, there's pictures all over the place about this one eagle in this one swamp, you know. And they've really, you know, just kept it up there. And that's just something of an example of a story that eventually may later on play out, you know. And, you know, and you also say about all of the animals. I mean, I grew up in the Poconos in Pennsylvania, where hunting was, you know, this past weekend it starts. And, you know, we always knew about that. I would go to my aunt's house, and, you know, 2 or 3 days after the hunting season started, and there'd be a selection of all these animals just strung up upside down on the patio to be able to start drying out. You know, there could be bear, there could be deer, pheasant, whatever. And, you know, we just always knew it. It was just the way of life, you know. But and deer was always so revered, you know, through the year, but then, you know, they went and hunted them too. So,
well, I think our ancestors were looking a lot at the natural world and trying to make sense of it. You see things, you don't understand them, and you try to piece it together. You cannot prove what was going on in our ancestors' minds because our ancestors are dead. But you can guess at it, and you can make informed guesses by looking at the evidence that we've got. And so, and that's what Science of the Magical is really all about. I mean, and of course, what we're talking about here, we're just skimming the surface. The book gets into much more detail. And, I mean, I can't begin to tell you how much fun it was to write. I really had a great time.
Well, Matt, it was a pleasure to have you with us today. Could you share a little bit, maybe in closing, we have about five more minutes, your favorite story of the book? I'll tell you, there's a million, so if you could share your favorite story, that would be great.
I think the thing that I found most interesting throughout my journeys was the story associated with Circe from the Odyssey. In the Odyssey, Odysseus is traveling home. It's a long journey. And as he gets to the island of Aea, he and his men are starving and exhausted. They get off their boats and decide that they need to look for shelter and food, and they split up. Half of the men, the group not with Odysseus, end up at this mansion in the wilderness. And from the front door of the mansion emerges a beautiful woman who welcomes them in for food and rest. Of course, all of them run in, with the exception of one who thinks it's probably a bad idea. She feeds them, and then she takes out her wand, and with a wave of her wand, she turns them all into animals. The one man who did not enter runs away, tells Odysseus, and realizing that it's probably a pretty bad idea that his men were all turned into animals, he decides to go run and try to save them. As he's running back, the myth tells us that he meets the god Hermes, who is commonly known as a messenger god, but was also for a long time associated with medicine. In fact, the caduceus, the coiled snakes associated with the symbol of medicine, were his staff. And so the symbol of medicine today actually comes from the staff he carried around with him. And Hermes says to Odysseus, "Slow down. Look, you can't fight Circe all on your own and unprotected. She's a dangerous witch. Take this." And he picks up a plant from the ground. It has a milk-white flower with a black root. And he says, "Consume this molly," that's what it's called, and Circe's magic will have no effect on you. Odysseus does what the god says, because when gods tell you to do something, you should usually do it. And then he goes and faces Circe. She makes him food. He eats it. She then points her wand at him and says, "Now join your friends in the pigsty." But instead of falling under the sway of her magic, he draws his sword and says, "Put down your wand." So that stuff has been disregarded as mythology for years. It's just fiction, right? Because no one can turn you into an animal, and there are no gods to give you magical herbs to protect you from the magic of a witch. But when you look at the artwork, recent artwork from the past 500 years almost always shows Circe with her wand out, pointed at the men, turning them into animals. But if you go way, way back to 400 BC and you look at the pottery that the Greeks were making, that is not what she's doing with the wand. Her wand is not pointed outward. Her wand is pointed in to a cup. She's using the wand as a stirrer to stir in poison. And the reason we know it's poison is because there's a passage in the Odyssey where it says, "Into the food that she gave the men, she mixed baneful drugs, such that they would forget their native land." Mm. For many years, folks have argued that this drug that was used was likely coming from a plant called Datura stramonium, also known as thorn apple. It has the ability to attack the neurotransmitter acetylcholine in the body. And this, that sounds very technical. The effect is bizarre behavior, a difficulty differentiating reality from fantasy, hallucinations, and wait for it, amnesia, which would make them forget their native land, exactly as it says in the story. So that's kind of fun. But the molly side of it, the side of the god Hermes giving Odysseus this protection against Circe's magic, comes across as really weird. We had no evidence of anything for a very long time. But then in 1951, a Russian pharmacologist named Mikhail Moshkovsky was traveling in the Ural Mountains, and he discovered that locals there were using a milk-white flower with a black root and crushing it and massaging it into the legs of patients suffering from polio, particularly children. And when Meshkovsky asked them, what are you doing? They said, we're using this to stave off the paralysis that the polio would likely cause. He brought the plant back to his laboratory and started experimenting with it, and he found that it had an uncanny ability to protect the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. That drug made its way into Bulgaria in the 1970s and was registered as Navalin, and eventually it made it into the modern world, the rest of the world, and into the United States. Today, if you have any family suffering from Alzheimer's, they're taking a drug called galantamine. It comes from a flower with a milky white color and a black root. It's known as snowdrop today. And so this whole tale, it likely has kernels of truth to it. Crucially, a team of neuroscientists in 1983 proposed at the 12th World Congress of Neurology that snowdrop was in fact Molly. And they did this by giving rats Molly, the snowdrop flower extract, before poisoning them with datura. And they showed that rats that were given the snowdrop first suffered no effect from the datura poisoning. And it lasts for quite a long time. So it's amazing stuff when you realize that something as mythical and seemingly completely fictitious as the Odyssey has little kernels of reality in there. I'm not saying Circe was real. I'm not saying Odysseus was real. But the concept of the poisonings that were being used and the effects of the poisons had suggested that our ancestors were meddling with this stuff and likely coming to conclusions that there was magic involved, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it is kind of cool. And, you know, there's a lot of fragrances out now and creams out and different things that have snowdrop in them, and it's really targeted towards the elderly population. It just, and you see a picture of an elderly woman smiling, sort of like just in the grace of their years, you know. It's just interesting to see that. You know, and in closing, I thought was really interesting too. You have a chapter in your book about superhumans, and you talked about walking on the coals now that they have such a resurgence of the Burning Man out in it was Arizona or California, I forget, just recently, you know. There's a lot of people starting that process up again. So, you know, things come around. You just don't know when, and, you know, things will be showing up full circle, I think.
Yeah. I mean, that chapter also, so the subsection that's found in is called Mischief and Trickery. And when you're dealing with walking on burning coals, there's a certain element of reality there. You have to know that the coals are ready to walk on. You have to know how to walk on them. There is a skill involved, definitely. But in large part, you'll notice that no one ever walks on coals during the day. The main reason for that is they would look like a bunch of gray ash. It only is done at night because that's when it looks impressive. There's a certain amount of misleading and trickery involved in walking on coals, just like laying on a bed of nails looks dangerous. But because you're distributing your weight across thousands of nails, the nails don't hurt you. So it's there's some chicanery and mischief involved that audiences need to be aware of.
Well, Matt, I think that was absolutely a wonderful time to speak with you today, because it really shows about, as you said, you know, it's, everything is magical, but there's science behind, and your book really does a great job at being able to say, this is the science and this is what we see. And I really enjoyed having you. So thank you so much for joining us.
It was absolutely my pleasure, and I do hope that everyone enjoys Science of the Magical. It was a great deal of fun to write.
Matt, can you share a little bit more information how people could find out about you?
Of course. They can go to Amazon.com and type in Science of the Magical. It's right there. They can go to Simon & Schuster's website where the book is published and also search Science of the Magical. If they want to find out more about me and my activities, they can go to www.amatteroffactandfiction.com. And there's videos of my antics, and I've got a friend named Charlie who I've gone on a lot of adventures with, so they can go and see those too.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a real pleasure.
It was my pleasure too. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you'd like to find out more information about Matt Kaplan, the link is on the bottom of today's show page. Again, the book is Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superhumans. Please do check out the book and do check out Matt Kaplan. It is a great read. I'll tell you, there are tons of information. There's a lot of documentation in the book. If you want to know where that study came from, where he found references, It's all there. So thank you so much for joining us today. And until tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.